That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
The time is 6 p.m. This is KGNU, Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM, 1390 AM with translator K229AC in Netherland, Colorado at 93.7 MHz. This program is presented by the KGNU Listener Member and by community-supported Art Colorado, providing shareholders with 9 original works of art by local artists. First distribution event is May 16th at Denver Botanic Gardens, presented by Boulder Museum of Contemporary Art and Denver Botanic Gardens. Information can be found at csartcolorado.org.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU Listener Member, and by Palisade Bluegrass Festival. 3 full days of live bluegrass is coming to Palisade, Colorado, June 15th through 17th for the 4th annual Palisade Bluegrass Festival. The festival features 3 days of live bluegrass, local food and libations, and family fun at Palisades Riverbend Park. This year's lineup features the Grammy Award-winning Carolina Chocolate Drops, along with Steel Drivers, Joe Pug, 18 South, April Virch, Lindsay Lou and the Flatbellies, and more. Camping and tickets are available until sold out at palisademusic.com. Festival activities, schedule, tickets, and more information is available online at palisademusic.com.
Welcome to Hemispheres. I'm your host, Nikki Kaiser. For the next hour, we'll take a look at current issues in and around Burma, or Myanmar, as they say, but I choose to call it Burma. A cyclone will hit Arakan State later this week, Thursday or Friday. It's called Cyclone Mahasin in the Bay of Bengal. And I wanted to check in on what are some of the changes that have occurred politically, socially, since the tsunami of 2008 hit the Irrawaddy Delta and killed about 150,000 people. I want to check in on the junta's current human rights record in general and the Rohingya Muslims in particular, since nearly half of the 100,000 or so Muslims who have fled the violence this summer and very recently are now in the path of this cyclone, living in tents in the low-lying areas at the coast up against the border with Bangladesh. How's the current leadership doing? Are there deep fractures in the quasi-civilian regime? A closed military dictatorship developing a modern democracy after 50 years of strict control is an interesting experiment. To help us sort it out, we have Jennifer Quigley, ED of U.S. Campaign for Burma, on the phone to orient us to the general conditions around Burma. Then I'll play a conversation I had earlier with Erica, who worked with the Rohingya Muslims who fled across the border, or the western border, into India. Most are still on the border, but she had a chance to work with a camp just outside of Delhi. But first, we'll hear from Myra, who is a Christian Karim. I'll only use people's first name for security reasons. She came from Karen State on the other side of Burma that borders Thailand. And I thought it was an interesting situation to look in on. This is a 50-year-old conflict with very similar elements to the current violence against the Rohingya Muslims. And we'll tell you more about what's going on currently. But first, let's check in with Myra. Since age 13, she's played a strong role in her community as a human rights advocate. She was an internally displaced person for about 12 years and a refugee for 17 until she resettled in the U.S. Myra has lost family members and friends to the brutality of Burma's military regime, so I wanted to find out from her what's going on now in Karen, 2 years into the new junta. First, she tells her story.
I was born as an internally displaced person in eastern Burma, Karen State, in a very remote, small village with a household of maybe 10 houses. It's a very remote area, so fighting has been going on, was going on back then pretty much on a regular basis. So we, the villagers, sort of like fall into the track between the two groups of people who are fighting, who were fighting between each other. And, of course, those are the Karen army and the Burmese army. And so a lot of time we become the subject to the abuses. So basically we had to flee most of the times for life. And so a lot of times when people ask me to describe my first one-third of my life in a couple words, I said, well, I guess the only word I could always describe is fear, because you turn right, left, back, forth, everything is like fear, 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 fear for life on a daily basis.
Were you in the jungly areas in the south?
It's a very jungle area. It's very remote. It's close to nowhere. Literally jungle, where there was no proper road, there is no health facility or school, there was no city or town close by where jungle people live.
Yeah, right.
That's how a lot of times my friends call me jungle woman.
Oh, hopefully affectionately. So it was basically living off the land. Did you have to keep moving to stay safe?
Yes. Basically, that was the first part of my life that I had to live sort of like, just like the nomadic people live their life, where we had to move from one place to another, always because the army would come into our villages, and then we literally had to jump out from our little shed and then disappear in jungle. And, of course, sometimes we just sleep in the bushes or sometimes under the trees, in the caves, constantly going on that way. And then started from late 70 to early 80, the situation got worse. The army came in not just burning down the houses, the villages, but they also planted landmines in order to prevent the villagers to come back and relive in the village. Back in mid-70s, the regime also imposed what they call four-cut policy in order to cut off the resistant groups, sort of like to weaken their connection with the outside people as well as the people in the community, and so that eventually the resistance groups, the army, will disappear. And so, of course, at one point it seemed as if it turns out to be ethnic cleansing, or you can even call it genocide. Those are like the real situation that has happened back then, and it's still going on until now.
So do you have a sense that over these 50 years, really, that the government has had a campaign against the Karen, that it's been fairly consistent that they've wanted to crush what I guess they see as a separatist movement?
Well, the problem with Burma is that they see us as the threat. And it's not only the Karen ethnic group. It's pretty much every other ethnic group in the country, whether Kachin or Shan or Arkanis or Mon, any other ethnic group that fight against them, any resistance group that stand up for themselves and fighting for their autonomy or greater human rights, let's say, or basic human rights, they all seem to be the threat for the central government, and therefore everyone who fight against them are their enemies, and they're trying to wipe out everybody. The civilians, the innocent people, become the victims in a very large scale.
Do you feel like there was particular fear for the Karen because as a group you folks were much more educated, you know, back in 62? You had more resources, you had contacts with the outside world, so was there possibly a little more fear against the Karen than, say, some other groups?
I'd say we all pretty much have the same level of fear. It just depends so much on where we are based and when is the attack. Of course, back in 70s, 80s, the Karen was a much stronger group, and therefore they were literally crushed on. But also the difference is that back then, whatever happens in Karen state, nobody outside the world knows. Firstly, the regime was not open to the world the way they do now. And secondly, those places are like literally jungle remote control area where nobody is allowed. So, of course, let alone we don't even talk about media outside of the country. But even our local community didn't even have the knowledge of getting their information out and telling the world. But the only difference these days is that because the world is open, people start knowing Burma more than many years ago, started from the 1988 uprising. So, of course, you get to hear about the Kachin situation, you get to hear about the Rohingya situation. But if this happened back in the 80s or 70s, nobody would hear about any of this.
Do you see the gradual opening up to the outside world and the lifting of the sanctions recently as basically a good thing?
The problem is that the opening is just superficial opening. It's not a sincere opening. The opening right now is not for the people, but it is just for the regime and its Western Asia colleagues, just for their own assessment.
Yeah, I wonder if this isn't another source of revenues, that if you open up, I mean, they've kind of milked the country on so many levels, maybe aid from international sources and so forth is just another source of revenues for the government.
The regime still blocked the aid that's supposed to go to the Kachin internally displaced person who have been displaced then for up there in Kachin state for 2 years. Another 100,000 plus in Western Burma, Arakan state, the Rohingyan people. And that doesn't count the internally displaced person that we have had in the past, almost 500,000 in Eastern Burma. The problem is the regime doesn't allow the aids to go to those who really need help.
Right, that's what I was saying. Yeah, so that this revenue could just go right into the pockets of those in power.
Yes.
And so, quote, democratizing or opening up to the world could just be another sort of scam for more money.
Yes, it is. I mean, I don't see anything wrong for us to say that. It's totally true.
What is going on now with the Karen people? How many internally displaced folks are there, would you say? And then how many folks are over the border into Thailand still?
The estimation, I'd say at least another 100,000. But the refugees in the refugee camp right now, the total number is around 140,000, 150,000. But also one has to remember that there are many internally displaced Karen who came into refugee camp without proper documentation. So basically, the total number could be higher than 150,000.
What do you see for the future for Karen people?
The situation is really fluid right now. Nobody can tell what is what and what is real and what is not. Even in the Karen leadership, there are a lot of problems that they have to figure out, as well as unity. But I do have hope that there is a potential, but we will have to work for it really hard. And that will take us a long time because the people on the ground are still suffering. What the regime troops use is that they use extortion in order to abuse the villagers. So they come into the villages, they ask for money, they ask for animals for food, they ask for people to go out and do forced labor for them. And on top of that, now they take the opportunity because they can travel more freely comparing to before. They're not going to get shot by the Karen army. So now they come up with their big trucks, load of rations, ammunition, all kinds of weapons, in order to build up their stronghold, to build up their camps much stronger than what they had before. And then who has to do all this hard labor work? The people who live in and around them. And these people have to do all this work without getting paid a penny instead. They have to bring their own food, and then they have to leave behind their own farm, their own orchard, where they can work and feed their family. This is the situation on the ground right now, but nobody knows about it.
So they're actually forced to do the work of those who are oppressing them. So
yeah.
Are these factions within the military? Are these people working sort of independently?
The people in the military.
Mm-hmm.
One has to remember that a lot of changes has happened, but the three main things that hasn't happened is the military is still control everything. The military is still on top of the power chain. And secondly, economic is still controlled by the regime and its cronies. And there is no judiciary, proper judiciary system. The judiciary system still serves the pleasure of the regime and its cronies and the military. So as long as these big points are fixed, we're not going to be able to get anywhere. The U.S. is moving too fast and too far just to give away everything, every leverage that we have had in the past years.
That was Myra speaking from Seattle, Washington, talking about her fellow Karen Christians and what's going to go on in the eastern state of Burma. We're looking all over Burma tonight on Hemispheres. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver. And we're doing that for a number of reasons. The last 2 years, Burma has made overtures to the international community saying that they're going to open up and hopefully encourage free press and all kinds of things. But it's a difficult transition from a very tight military dictatorship for 50 years into the modern world. We're wondering how that's happening, maybe a little bit in fits and starts. So we're checking in around the country of Burma. And we were going to have the executive director of U.S. Campaign for Burma on the line, but unable to reach her, so we're going to go to Erica. Now, just to set the stage for Erica's thoughts, last June and again in October, there were deadly clashes between Rakhine Buddhists and Rohingya Muslims that left 190 people dead and 100,000 people, mostly Muslims, displaced. The current regime, which is Thein Sein, is accused of consistently obstructing the delivery of humanitarian aid to them, and the camps are reportedly overcrowded with lack of water, shelter, adequate food, sanitation, and so forth, medical care. In March, a dispute at a gold shop in the central town of Myekatlia led to more violence between Buddhists and Muslims, and an entire Muslim neighborhood was burned to the ground, 40 people killed, and 12,000 Muslims fled their homes. Now, that's in the inner part of Burma, the internal valley. And then May 1st, anti-Muslim violence broke out in Okan, north of Rakhine, which is down in the south along the border, but in the middle of the country. Buddhist mobs attacked mosques and torched 77 homes. One mosque and some shops were destroyed by the violence. So we're seeing an increase of anti-Muslim violence all throughout Burma. I spoke with Erica yesterday. She works with Burmese refugees in Seattle, Washington. She and her family, actually, a 12-year-old daughter and her husband, volunteered with Rohingya in an encampment outside of Delhi. This is what she has to say.
Rohingya refugees, who aren't actually refugees, as they don't qualify for refugee status, they're stateless, but also Chin, who had fled religious persecution from Chin State in Burma into northeastern India. So I had followed their situation and learned about an encampment where over 200 Rohingya had settled temporarily and were really fleeing the persecution that had taken place in June of last year. So we were there on the heels of that, and they were just newly arrived. We had planned on going into organized visual storytelling workshops where the kids could paint pictures, sort of tell their stories. These paintings are often really powerful advocacy tools, but when we arrived, we recognized just how vulnerable they were physically, sort of their skin conditions, all sorts of ailments. When we showed up, they weren't expecting us, and most of the children, little kids, were running around naked in this cardboard encampment in an open field. And so instead of doing a workshop, we ended up, thanks to Facebook, connecting with folks who had grown up in India and had doctor friends, medic friends in the Delhi area to organize a couple of medic camps, impromptu medic camps. And then right before we left Delhi, we did go back and have a visual storytelling workshop.
So these were makeshift camps outside of Delhi, similar to the ones that have cropped up on the border between Burma and Bangladesh, a result of Muslims fleeing from the violence between local Buddhists and Muslims. I guess about 100,000 people were homeless from that violence. And I understand that you can see, even from the air, the effects of the burned-out villages and the mass graves that they left behind in Rangkeng State. What did the Rohingya Muslims that you met describe? What happened back home in Burma?
The paintings that came out of there, where we were asking them everything from, you know, what are your dreams to the future, what do you miss most about your native land, which was Burma, to why were you forced to flee? Every child painted why they were forced to flee, and the images were so gruesome that I felt like, wow, these kids deserve to be heard. They deserve to have an audience. And so that really propelled me to start working more closely with the various Rohingya groups who are really working to build bridges across ethnic and religious divides. I think that's one of the really rare efforts where people are trying to solve the problem as opposed to just pointing fingers and name-calling and polarizing.
Can you tell us some of their stories, for example, that might highlight what happened?
Well, the paintings, they described through translators being in their village and people, Burmese, Arkanis, the Rakhine, who are Buddhists, had come with machetes. And so there are pictures of people with machetes, with pictures of guns. There was a lot of blood. There were images of fires. It was striking to see an image of a helicopter, making me think, you know, were there state security forces coming in here that we hadn't read about? There was an image in one case of a child fleeing by boat, and there was a UNHCR symbol that they had painted, suggesting that they dreamed of gaining refugee status and being able to be finally feeling safe. In fact, when they got to Delhi, the United Nations High Commission for Refugees does not accept them, does not grant them refugee status because they're stateless, which means that they don't have citizenship anywhere in the world, even in the land in which they were born and raised. That was stripped of them by the citizenship law in 1982. So they're in this sort of state of purgatory. And for me, the idea of being stateless, being in a place where nowhere in the world are you welcome, just felt like the most desperate of all.
Would statehood or citizenship in some country be a solution? Would it improve their lot?
I think for them, short term, it certainly would improve their lot to be able to put down roots and become independent. They were all, the adults were expressing their desire to have jobs and be able to support their families rather than living in cardboard shacks, uncertain of their future and having to rely on people to make donations.
Would it also help them, anyone who harmed them, be prosecuted? Because then they'd be citizens that have rights of protection.
Well, I think that just having a place that is yours, having a place to call home as opposed to always being, no matter where you turn, considered an illegal, undocumented Bengali, which is how they've been branded in Rakhine State, to have a place that is rightfully yours, that is legally yours, that you can justify your very existence in a place, just for starters, gives peace of mind. And so to think of these children growing up in families where they know there is nowhere that they belong. There's nowhere that they can feel safe. So you can imagine why these paintings were consistently about the stress and violence that they either felt or they perceived they were going to feel. There was just a lot of fear and paranoia.
And so this is in the northwestern corner of Burma on the side towards India, to give people a sense of reference. So how did the Rohingya get there?
Well, there are many Rohingya who were born and raised there and have been there, their families have been there for generations. There's evidence of that. There are others who have come from Bangladesh. People who are Rohingya, I know someone who's in British Columbia, Canada, has sent me evidence of documents showing the word Rohingya on documents that go back to the early 1900s.
Yeah, I understand that for 30 years, the Burmese government has denied citizenship to 800,000 or so Rohingya people living within its borders, about 4% of its population, leaving them without a country of their own. And I guess the UN has described them as one of the world's most persecuted minorities. I guess legend holds it that they are descendants of Arab traders that were shipwrecked on the coast of Burma in the 18th century, so definitely not new arrivals. But I guess their language, that is a Bengali dialect, is so similar to the one that's spoken in southeast Bangladesh that the Rohingya are seen as illegal immigrants, Bengalis, and that that's a misunderstanding that is perpetuated maybe by the folks in Rangoon and the ordinary Burmese seem to believe.
There is evidence that they're not new arrivals. There's debate over people coming who are undocumented. You know, are they illegal? Are they undocumented? Do they deserve to be here if they've fled extreme poverty, if they're just trying to do what we're all trying to do, which is be healthy and happy and secure and take care of our families? I think that in Rakhine State, they're in a position of having to continually defend themselves. Before the outbreak of violence last June, there were simmering tensions. And I think this is part of the democracy movement in Burma. It can unleash deep-seated expressions of racism and discrimination. And so things that were sort of kept in check by a military state have been released. And so it wasn't brand new, the violence or the expression of hatred and racism. It was simply unleashed, especially if at the same time you're receiving anti-Muslim propaganda. And what happened was initially people thought, okay, it's targeting the Rohingya, the quote-unquote illegal Bengalis. And then it spread beyond Rakhine State, and the violence has affected Muslims who have legal citizenship, there's no question about their citizenship. And so now Muslims throughout the country are living in fear of, you know, will they be next? I mean, there have been outbreaks of violence in the capital. There have been outbreaks of violence in central Burma. They've even spread to regions that aren't primarily Buddhist.
So you're talking about the recent conflicts between Buddhists and Muslims and
right.
That are happening throughout the country. Let's move now to what is going on. Do you feel, having seen the pictures that the kids drew, that there is some complicity with the regime? And if so, can you speculate as to why they would support the conflict between Muslims and Buddhists?
What I have seen are videos of security forces, state security forces, simply standing by and watching as Muslims are being brutalized in different parts of Burma. And then others have felt like, yes, there are security forces who are actually pawns or puppets of portions of the government, the military. So even if the Burmese president tries to stop the violence, the 2008 constitution does not grant him total control over the military.
So that brings up a whole question of leadership. So it may be one group, the military, may have some vested interest in some conflict between Buddhists and Muslims. Do you think that because the Rohingya do not have citizenship, that it's easier for prejudice against them to build, that they're somehow less welcome in Burma and therefore maybe more easily victimized?
I think they're definitely scapegoats.
What are you hearing from the Burmese folks in Seattle about the current situation with Rohingya?
Well, it's been interesting because most of the people I'm hearing from are actually in Burma or on the borders of Burma. But here in Seattle, there are also people who've resettled. And the points of view are extremely varied. There are, in fact, people who fled Burma in 1988 following the 1988 student-led uprising. And some of them have friends in Rakhine State. And some of them, at meetings, have been explosive about the Rohingya, claiming that they're potential terrorists, They don't belong to be there. They're, again, illegal Bengali. And then there are others who really believe that here we are living in a democracy. And once you become aware of human rights and really the rights and responsibilities within a democracy, you recognize that diversity really is key to the success of a democracy, having different points of view, having people who challenge what is your limited experience. And so they have really strived to not only help build those bridges, those ethnic and religious bridges in Burma, but also here within the Seattle community amongst the refugees who've settled recently.
Interesting. So folks that are experiencing democracy being in the U.S. are learning about democracy.
Refugee youth here in the Seattle area are learning about human rights, whose parents are really afraid to speak out. We've had demonstrations. There was a demonstration in relation to the 2007 Saffron Revolution. There was another one which had to do with the fourth anniversary of that. And there were a lot of parents of refugee children who were afraid for them to participate, who had grown up being afraid of authorities.
Sure.
If police were to come, if security were to come, these were people who could actually hurt you and at worst send you back to Burma.
Do you think their experience of democracy is then getting exported back to Burma through relatives that are already there slowly?
I think it is a little bit. I mean, we've seen how the real steps towards democracy, however small, have taken place where the international spotlight has been, the media has been. So in the capital, you've seen big strides in terms of the easing of media censorship. We've also seen the release of thousands of political prisoners. They haven't all been released. There are still over 300, we hear, and there have been many ceasefire agreements signed. But then in the ethnic minority areas, where a lot of people continue to feel vulnerable, you don't see as many changes. There are still about 140,000 refugees living in 9 UNHCR-sponsored camps along the Thai-Burma border. If they really felt safe, they would have returned.
You were saying that some of the conflict between Muslims and Buddhists in the Upper West Rincon State are symptomatic of the whole country. Can you explain that more?
There's actually a monk, his name is Wirathu, who has called himself the Burmese bin Laden, and he has initiated what he calls the 969 campaign. It's an anti-Muslim campaign where you put this sticker, this sign on your shop, and it means I don't sell to Muslims, or you put it on your taxi, I don't give them a ride, I don't buy from Muslims, and he's saying we should not marry Muslims. It's something that is eerily reminiscent of the Nazi era, and the fact that he hasn't been stopped, he hasn't been challenged by the government. There could be something from Aung San Suu Kyi, but they've been very silent. And this is after having experienced in 2007 with the Saffron Revolution this brutal crackdown on Burmese Buddhist monks. So we know they're capable of moving quickly. So clearly there is reluctance from state security forces, who in a lot of cases have, again, stood by and watched as violent acts have been committed, and in some cases even been seen on video participating in them.
So beyond complicity, they may be actually fomenting some of these divides?
And what I don't know is how much of that is the individual soldier on the ground and how much of it is higher up leadership directing their efforts or lack of efforts.
Can you tell us a story or two of people that you're working with in Seattle and how it is? You say the majority arrived after the 1988 student uprisings. Why did they leave and what did they experience at home?
I mean, I can tell you stories about what's happening in Burma right now for individuals.
Okay.
Especially those who are speaking out on behalf of human rights and are being imprisoned because of it. It's sort of an indication that the democracy movement isn't as far along as the mainstream media portrays it to be. There are refugees, for example, from Chin State, where they're Christian. And again, there's religious and has been religious persecution. And so many of them have fled out of Chin State into northeastern India and then made their way to Delhi, where the United Nations High Commissioner refugees, able to grant them refugee status, and then they're able to resettle abroad. there are those who have fled, for instance, Karen State, which is along the Thai-Burma border, and they may have been child soldiers. They may have been forcibly abducted. We did visual storytelling workshops with children who painted, being one child was 12 years old. He was forcibly abducted from school, and finally when he escaped, he just ran, and he ran, and he ran, and he ran until he crossed the border, and he hadn't seen his family since. There were other children who had been trafficked or who had been smuggled, and they painted pictures of what it was like to be told that you're being given, perhaps your parents had even thought they were sending you to a better opportunity to get an education in Thailand, and they had paid an agent to take the child across the border, and instead the person had trafficked them. And so we did a workshop in a shelter for kids who had been trafficked, and these were young children who recalled what it was like to go from dreaming about this brighter future to then discovering that they had been enslaved by someone, and there was no one to ask for help. There's no one to tell, because the threat was, well, then we will tell that you're not legal here in Thailand. And so they continued to provide slave labor in garment factories, on fishing boats. There were children who had fled for health reasons. I remember in India being moved by a girl whose father had AIDS in Burma, and there was so much discrimination against him that she had to take her little brother, who was two at the time, to India to be able to make enough money to then send back to support her father, because he couldn't have supported them. Her mother had died. So there were, every child had a different story. Every child's paintings raised different issues about why people have been forced to flee.
Who was doing the enslaving, for example, on in Karen State?
Well, when it comes to the enslaving, I mean, that would take place in Thailand. So you may have someone who portrays himself as an agent to take a child across the border for an education, but instead is a smuggler who's connected with, let's say, a garment factory or a fishing boat, and then sells the child.
Oh, okay.
To this owner, and then the child has to earn their freedom back.
Right. So these are entrepreneurial middlemen, in essence,
right.
Just renegades. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not really a concerted effort. It's just people who are vulnerable to whomever might take advantage of them in any way.
In a country where you don't understand what human rights are, you don't know what you deserve to expect. And so when you get even to a place like Thailand, a democracy, you don't know, you don't have the confidence that if you speak out, someone would actually help you.
You mentioned that in the last several years, there's been reforms that have taken place that have actually helped the situation. What are they?
I think the easing of media censorship has been really helpful, along with social media, to get the word out to people about what sorts of issues are still existing in Burma. I think a lot of people were following the government's propaganda, going back to the military regime before this new quasi-civilian leadership. I think a second one is the number of political prisoners who have been released. For me, it's not really a release, though, if you're released conditionally. In other words, if you do something to upset the government, then you can be sent back to prison to fulfill the rest of your original sentence. For example, one of the organizers of the 2007 Saffron Revolution, his name is Ashin Gambira, he was sentenced to 68 years in prison. He was in solitary confinement. For 4 years, he was tortured. And then finally, last January of 2012, he was released. But along with the other political prisoners who were released at that time, it was a conditional release. So when last November, November 19th, President Obama came and he spoke in Burma, and he actually met with Gambira, the week after that, Gambira was imprisoned again. For whatever random reason, he was sent back, and for 2 days, not even his family knew where he was. Eventually, he was released again. But it sort of shows you that when you're released conditionally, once a political prisoner in Burma, always a political prisoner in Burma. And again, there continue to be hundreds of political prisoners still waiting behind bars. The vast majority are ethnic minorities who are not well known, who don't have Amnesty International campaigning for them, who don't have Human Rights Watch keeping them on their radar. These are people who have fled ethnic minority regions and often are far removed from where their families are. So they're the most easily forgotten, and I think that one indication, in addition to the fact that not all political prisoners have been released, is the fact that for up until recently, the government denied the existence of political prisoners. If you look at the 2008 Constitution, they're saying, well, they broke laws. Well, so one of the laws is you're challenging different points of view or state security or the harmony within a community, then of course you're breaking a law.
So do you see that Gambira's meeting with Obama was window dressing, would you call that?
I know that he met with him and other former political prisoners behind closed doors, and our expectation was by putting Gambira in the spotlight with Obama, by having that association be there worldwide, it would keep him safe. But it had the exact opposite effect. They withheld his national identification. So he is now in a place where he's never had his national ID returned. There's no way he can apply for a passport. There's no way he can travel. So he remains very vulnerable.
So do you distrust, as long as the 2008 Constitution is in place and the mentality that challenging the state makes you a criminal, do you not see much reform going on?
Someone can feel like they have freedom of speech, but they could say the wrong thing to the wrong person and get in serious trouble. It hasn't changed.
So you question the sincerity of the regime that says that they want to become a part of the international community and they want to democratize?
There are many representatives, including many people from the military, who are guaranteed 25% of the seats in parliament, who have a vested interest in things not changing. And so you have this sort of tug of war, and I think that probably a lot of the pressure will come from the younger generation. Right now, this really started earlier this year, there's an interfaith youth movement. It's a coalition of people representing different ethnic and religious groups that is challenging, really discrediting Wiradhoo's anti-Muslim movement. And it's really calling people on their racism.
Or do you think that possibly this is another flavor of opportunism, that by welcoming the international community and getting aid coming in, that there's a chance for increased revenues and corruption?
From knowing people who are working as lobbyists, working with the Burmese government, I can't help but believe there are some people who are in it for the right reasons and are taking steps on a tightrope walk, because if they take too bold of a step, they can lose the majority. They can lose the military support. If they take too timid of a step, they can lose the world's support and credibility in the global economy. So I think there are people who want these changes, but there are many others who feel deeply threatened by the changes and are just holding clenched fists onto the past.
Do you think Aung San Suu Kyi is one of the people who's trying to tread the waters carefully, the balance between opening things up and speaking out, but also not threatening the powers that be too strongly, too quickly?
I think she's definitely one of the people. I mean, she's disappointed deeply so many people who had sacrificed for her to be in the position she's in now. We see videos showing people screaming into her face over why isn't she speaking up on their behalf the way she used to before she became part of parliament. But I think she has her eye on 2015 and the elections. 2015 and the chance to become president of Burma as being better for the country long term.
What should the U.S. policy be towards Burma, given your example of Gambira's meeting with Obama and how badly it went?
The U.S., just like the EU, is lowering sanctions. And they're sort of, at the same time, the Burmese government uses political prisoners as bargaining chips. no, we will release some political prisoners if you lower some more sanctions. And when Obama went to Burma in November, a lot of people said, this is great. He's going to introduce the country to human rights. He's going to support democracy and Aung San Suu Kyi. And then afterwards, a lot of people felt like he went prematurely, because look at all these problems that have emerged since that time, including the Buddhist-Muslim violence, the sort of anti-Muslim movement that is spreading around the country.
That was Erica in Seattle giving us a view of what's going on with the Muslims on the western side of Burma. You're listening to KGNU Boulder, Denver, 88.5 FM and 1390 AM. This is Hemispheres, and I'm your host, Nikki Kaiser. I wanted to add to Erica's story that The Independent reports that state security forces failed to stop the violence or protect citizens, and in some cases were direct participants in the violence this summer. July, a month after the violence began, the Burmese president, Thein Sein, is quoted as saying that he was calling for illegal Rohingya to be sent to third countries. In October, there was a coordinated campaign of ethnic cleansing in 9 more townships that sought to remove or relocate the state's Muslim population. And a reporter for The Guardian, David Mafam, said that he found local Arakanis, that's people in Arakan, that's the state that we're talking about, where the violence has recently erupted since summer, that the political party officials there, Buddhist monks and ordinary Arakanis, were directly supported by state security forces. So there's huge, huge challenges for the current regime. That's been a junta that started 2 years ago, and there's been a whole history, as we've seen, over 50 years of ethnic cleansing and violence against ethnic groups. The Shan are a very well-known group that's also had a great deal of struggle to be able to survive at all. And our show will continue. In just a few minutes, you're listening to Hemispheres on KGNU.
What's the purpose?
You were listening to Bombay Dub, a cut called Compassion, and Burning Bridges, Feast of Fools, I Don't Want to Quit. You've been listening to Hemispheres on KGNU, Boulder, Denver. I'm your host, Nikki Kaiser. We were discussing issues in Burma. And so I wanted to give you some resources for more information. The Karen Women's Organization, you can find at karenwomen.org. Karen American Communities Foundation is at karenusua.org. That's one faction of the several factions that are fighting for Karen independence on the east side of Burma. Our guests are from U.S. Campaign for Burma, so you can find them at uscampaignforburma.org. There's a lot of information there. They have an interactive website that details human rights abuses, and it gives many lists of organizations that are involved both within Burma, around Burma, and on the borders. And then Irrawaddy.org is also a great source of information. You've been listening to Hemispheres, and you can re-listen to this show or download a recording of the show on our archives at kgnu.org. If you have comments about this or any other show on KGNU, please leave a message on our comment line, 303-447-9911. Please stay tuned, because Corriente sigue. This program is made possible by KGNU listener members and by Savory Spice Shop in Boulder, home of thyme, basil, cinnamon, and many spices and seasonings. Find out how over 400 herbs and spices from 7 continents and ethnic groups can get along peacefully all on one shelf. More information can be found at savoryspiceshop.com, Boulder, or by calling 303-444-0668.
This program is brought to you by the KGNU listener members and by Mahler Fest 26, with a symposium and 2 performances at Mackey Auditorium of Mahler's 4th Symphony and Der Abschied, May 17th to the 19th. Details at mahlerfest.org.
The time is 7 o'clock. You're listening to KGNU, Boulder, Denver. Thank you.
Thank you.